You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Stefan Thomke. Stefan is the leading authority on management of innovation and the William Barclay Harding Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. He's the author of Experimentation Matters, Unlocking the Potential of New Technologies for Innovation, as well as over 100 articles, cases, and notes published in books and journals such as Harvard Business Review, Management Science, and MIT Sloan Management Review. He has chaired numerous executive education programs, both at Harvard Business School and in companies around the world. He has a new book. It's called Experimentation Works, The Surprising Power of Business Experiments. Stefan Thomke, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Kelly.
So this podcast is being recorded on Thursday, March 26th, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. So we're starting all of these episodes with a quick check-in. How are you doing, and where are you talking to us from?
You know, I'm doing fine. I am at home, just like many people.
Yep.
And in my home office, where I'm reading, writing, and talking to people. And, you know, family is at home as well, and just watching all of this unfold. And you know, I'm thinking a lot about sort of what's going on right now as it relates to my new book as well. So there are definitely actually a number of connections.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. And I'm recording from my home, and you may have heard my Bernese Mountain Dog Benchley barking just a second ago. Hopefully not. Hopefully we'll tighten the audio. But in the introduction to the book, you write, "For better or worse, our actions tend to rely on experience, intuition, and beliefs. But this all too often doesn't work." That seems very relevant to what's going on right now.
Of course, yes. And in fact, there's another passage that I have actually on the sleeve of the book, and it says, "Don't fly blind, see how the power of experiments works for you."
Mm.
And I think flying blind is part of the story right now that we're seeing unfold here. And that is, you know, as we're trying to figure out what to do and how to manage sort of this public health crisis, a lot of us are in fact flying blind because we just don't have the data to make the right decisions.
Or we weren't listening to the data that we maybe do have.
That's going on as well, for sure. And there is some data. There are some data that, of course, that we need to listen to and that some of our leaders are quite happy to ignore. But the reality is, when you actually look at some of the really good writing about this from biostatisticians and all that, and they're telling us that because of the lack of data that we have is, you know, the range of possibilities is just so huge.
Right.
And it comes down to testing and experimentation. You know, we just don't have good testing strategy. It's now changing a little bit, but we kind of missed this.
Yeah, I mean, that word testing is, you know, every hour you're hearing it, and lack of testing, and how, you know, in certain countries it appears, certainly ones that have a more totalitarian approach to this, they can stamp this down. But in places like, well, Italy and America and France, you can just see the difference in the reaction here.
Kelly, I've been researching and writing about testing and experimentation for more than 25 years now. And what's really amazing is the number of articles about testing in the general media that I've seen in the last few weeks, of course, completely outdid anything that I've seen in the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just the quantity of things that are written about that. So at one level, I'm quite happy that finally, you know, this awareness of sort of the importance on the value of testing has gone up exponentially. You know, I'm on the other hand, I'm a little sad that it took a major health crisis to have that aha moment. And in fact, one of the problems I think in this on all of this is that that we should have thought about this before, you know, the crisis hit us. You know, there should have been a much sort of broader awareness, and there should have been kind of a strategy, sort of how to approach this from a testing point of view before. Because once you enter the crisis, it's not so easy to scale that up.
In the part of the book where you talk about the innovation challenge, you talk about how companies really struggle innovation because there's so much uncertainty. But you also note in the book, and I think that's what you're talking about here, that, quote, in innovation, uncertainty is necessary because it creates opportunity, end quote. And that's, yes, unfortunate that it's pandemic, but indeed, sometimes you don't know, and we certainly know this in the field of improvisation, you get thrown the curveball, and that's where a lot of magic happens.
Absolutely. And I do believe that, you know, the answer to solving this crisis is, in fact, lots of experimentation and innovation. I mean, that's what's going to get out of this one. And so at one level, it's terrible kind of to see what's going on in hospitals around sort of the country or around the world. At the same time, you know, and we're seeing this already, right? People are trying a lot of different things. Some of it is really more trying willy-nilly, more trial and error, but some of it is much more structured, much more disciplined in terms of how we're experimenting. So that to me is kind of the light, the ray of sunshine that's kind of hitting us here as well, is that there's just a lot going on right now. And it also says something about kind of the pioneering spirit, you know, that people have here. They want to do something. They don't want to just sit around in their homes and waiting for this to unfold in front of their eyes. They want to solve it. They want to help. And so that's great. So uncertainty, yes. So uncertainty is really the underlying issue. And that's why whether you're entering a crisis or whether you're trying to innovate, uncertainty is kind of the name of the game. And we have different ways of dealing with uncertainty. We deal through it in most cases through experience. But as we're seeing right now, sometimes, you know, experience can be quite limiting. In fact, you know, and quite often we don't have experience with something that happens, you know, maybe once in 50 or once in 100 years. We can use big data and analytics. But the problem here, again, with big data and analytics is that, you know, first of all, that it relies on data that's already out there. But, you know, if the data is already out there, that means that whatever you're trying is not very novel because, you know, by the virtue of, you know, things being novel, that is, if data is out there already, it means someone must have already done it or it must have already happened. And it gives us correlations as well. When we do a lot of big data analysis, we don't get causation. And right now, we really need a lot of answers. We need to know that if we try X, Y happens. And so there's a lot of this going on right now, which I talk about sort of in detail in my book.
I was very lucky and got a sneak peek at some chapters of Danny Kahneman's book that he's working on, which is all about noise. And that's another problem here, right, when you're talking about big data, because you have to separate what the noise might be.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's what we call, I'm an engineer by background, by the way, Kelly, as you said, and we call it this, we have a thing called the signal to noise ratio.
Yeah.
And what you want to do is you want to be in an environment where the signal is very strong and the noise is very low, because when you have a high signal to noise, you can then distinguish, you know, sort of cause and effect from sort of background noise. And when you have a low signal to noise ratio, you know, you just get a lot of nonsense, but you can't really sort of conclude anything from it. So that's what we're doing here. So when you're designing smart experiments, or when you're designing smart tests, you want to design them in the way that you have high signal to noise ratio, so you can conclude something from that.
In the section on what makes a good business experiment, I was thinking, you know, improvisation is a very, very failure forward industry. And you had a quote by Jeff Bezos, and he said, quote, "One area where I think we are especially distinctive is failure. I believe we are the best place in the world to fail, and failure and invention are inseparable twins." That would actually confuse certain people who would be like, why failure? But what I think we know, and you know, is that this is how you get to the answer, by many, many different kinds of failures.
Absolutely, Kelly. And the way I usually explain it, I draw a distinction between what I call failures, which are the good things, you know, because we learn from that, and mistakes, which is a word that is semantically very close to failure, but it's something very different. A mistake to me is something where there is no learning. You know, there's no question that you're trying to answer here. So, you know, Amazon, since you mentioned Bezos here, you know, when Amazon builds yet another distribution warehouse, you know, they're not looking to for answers to a question. This is just operational execution. And if something goes wrong, because they've built so many of those, if something goes wrong, it's just poor operational execution. It's a mistake. But failures, sort of the good failures, are preceded by a question. There's a question that you answer. And it turns out when you're running lots of experiments, usually the starting point of a new experiment is the end point, perhaps even a failure of a previous experiment. So it's not a one-time event. You know, lots of these failures lead to new hypotheses, which are then getting tested again in experiments and so on and so on. So what we want to do is we want to create an environment that values these good failures while at the same time trying to minimize mistakes. Mm-hmm. And that requires leadership. It requires an honest communication sort of with people where I would talk about, you know, failures that I've had sort of in my career and what I've learned from it and so on.
In this section too, you talk about the quote from the book is, "Testing customers' actual behavior is more important than trusting what they say they do." And I have been in these focus groups, and like people aren't necessarily telling you the truth in those things.
Oh, not for sure. I mean, for a number of reasons. First of all, I mean, what happens in a focus group? You're taking a group of people in some conference into some conference room, so the environment is already somewhat artificial.
Yeah.
Then they're part of a group, right? So you will, you know, listen to what other people say. You know, you'll be influenced by what other people say. You know, you may be in an environment, you know, that really has nothing to do with the actual use conditions of a product that you're trying to learn about. And so we know very well that that there are some great limitations to focus groups. And in fact, you know, there's an example in the book which is great from Intuit. Mm. And Intuit sort of had so there was an insight, you know, sort of they were basically offering payroll software. And sort of in the example, they found that there was an interesting insight that they had. They found that new potential customers were actually coming sort of to the software hours before they needed to make payroll. And usually the way sort of this payroll software is set up, that it would take, you know, sometimes days to qualify somebody to actually pay, to make payroll. And so someone had this insight, and they thought, wouldn't that be an interesting kind of business proposition here if we kind of offered sort of this capability to allow sort of new customers to make payroll right away? Mm-hmm. And so they went out and they actually you know, did a little bit of research on that and asked sort of their existing customers, and they found that nobody was interested in that feature. And they were just about ready to kind of give up on it, and until finally said, why don't we actually run a test and see what happens? And so what they did is they actually created sort of a button sort of on the software, and they asked basically a sort of a new customer sort of coming online and asked them whether they wanted to make payroll right away. And turned out that a lot of people actually clicked on that button. They were they were interested in actually making payroll. And so that what they did, by the way, is they didn't actually offer that feature. Then it basically said the feature is under construction. But they wanted to kind of get a sense of how many people are actually interested in it by with sort of the behavior rather than what they say. And so we see this a lot. I mean, the book has a lot of examples on this. And I'm quite honestly, Kelly, I would rather trust sort of what people do and how they behave than what they tell me.
Yeah, and you don't know that until you test it out. The one other story I liked about this was the one from Philips, the Dutch tech company, when they were doing the focus group for teenagers. So that was boom boxes, right?
Yes, and you know, and they ran this focus group, and one of the rewards of this focus group was that you actually get a boom box. So what they did is, in the focus group, sort of they asked them which color they would like. And of course, you know, they all wanted to look cool and they picked kind of some really fancy bright colors. But when they actually offered them the boom boxes on the way out, they all sort of picked sort of the most boring color, which was black. So you want to be cool in front of others, but when you actually make your choice, when you're thinking about yourself, maybe you value something that's very different.
So that's kind of a simple, you know, the person-to-person example. I thought the Cracker Barrel Old Country Store story was a really interesting way to figure out what the problem or issue was.
Yes, I mean, so here's another story of an experiment. So, you know, as you know, Cracker Barrel is sort of a chain of stores in the U.S., and they were facing sort of an interesting challenge. You know, corporate headquarters kind of told them that they want us to switch to LED lighting. So they wanted to know whether kind of LED lighting actually has an impact on sales. So, you know, everybody wants to kind of switch to basically better lighting and all that. And so they implement this lighting. And what's kind of interesting is, and they found that as a result of sort of LED lighting, suddenly sales would go down. And they all scratched their head. And they thought, oh man, you know, maybe customers don't like the LED lighting. And it turned out that when they started to investigate, the effect was a very different one. And that is, before LED lighting was used, sort of basically, you know, every store set up its own lighting sort of basically on the front porch to attract customers. And some of that lighting actually violated company policy. So they made it extra bright, for example. Right. When they introduced sort of LED lighting, they now all conformed to sort of this new company policy. And it turned out that it actually sort of lowered the lighting sort of on the front porch. The customers couldn't actually see the stores. And so this is an example, again, of unintended consequences. So when you're running a test or when you're running an experiment and you look at the results, you need to investigate. And this is a big problem, you know, that we have as people, of course, as we're thinking about sort of our own biases. You know, we're human nature, you know, we tend to happily accept good results and good results that really confirm our biases, but we then challenge and thoroughly investigate bad results that go against our assumptions. And so we need to investigate all of these kinds of things, because the conclusion from that test could have been saying LED lighting is actually bad for stores and we should not do this, but that was the wrong conclusion.
And you mentioned the word conformity, and I was surprised as I was going through your book about how much of this book is a culture book, because it is, and you write in the book, creating a culture where the right ideas, not seniority, win, and these hierarchies can really be damaging to places of innovation, even if we're talking about, you know, technical and online and places where we don't necessarily think of needing a sort of like even an entertainment or theatrical culture where we have a lot of non-hierarchical interactions.
turns out, Kelly, that culture is a huge piece in this. You know, even though the book, you know, explains, you know, some of the tools and some of the infrastructure that you need to run experiments at large scale, turns out that if you want to really be successful at this, you need a total change of attitude. And so, so I explain in the book the different cultural elements that are necessary in order for this to work. And I'll give you a few examples. You know, I've got seven elements in one of the chapters, but let me give you a few of those. Mm-hmm. First one is what I call cultivate curiosity. And so you need, in order for this to happen, in order sort of for people to go out and to test and to experiment, everyone from the leadership down needs to value surprises, because you can't really put a dollar value sort of on them, and you can't really predict sort of how they sort of turn out. So when you need to adopt this mindset, and then curiosity will prevail, and then people will see failures not as costly mistakes, but as opportunities for learning. First, the second is you need to insist that data trump opinions. Mm. And again, this is really hard because, you know, we tend to have very strong opinions. We you know, our belief systems, and there are lots of sort of reasons why we tend to rely on these kinds of opinions, and it's really hard, and you know, and human nature really sort of gets in the way. The third one is what I call democratized experiments as well. So you need to empower people to run these experiments, to run these tests, often without management permission. So mm-hmm. for that to happen, of course, you need a kind of a very transparent environment. You need to have checks and balances and all these kinds of things. You need to also, fourth one, and then you need to be ethically sensitive, of course, when you're running experiments. You need to make sure that they're ethical experiments. And then the fifth one, which you alluded to, which I think is perhaps the most difficult but also the most important, is you need a different leadership model. You need to rethink sort of what the role of senior leaders is in this kind of environment. And I think some senior leaders have a really tough time with this.
You know, this was interesting because the Post-it note story, which I certainly have heard, it is often this like, oh, this incredible innovation story. Of course it is. But there was a serious lag time here that where there was no innovation happening, right?
Oh, this is what often happens, you know, in innovation. I mean, we always hear these stories, what's often left out is all the hard work that goes into this, and all the failures that come along the way. Even something like the Apple Store, which you know is the most successful retail concept probably in the last decade or two, probably in the last two decades, even that had pretty tough time initially. And so there's a lot of persistence in making innovation work. It's a lot of, again, a lot of failures sort of along the way, and learning from them and iterating until you get it right.
Yeah, so in the case of the Post-it, this chemist, Spencer Silver, you know, basically made this discovery, and it took him 5 years before someone was like, oh yeah, we could make something out of this.
Yes, and in fact, in this case, you know, he did exactly the opposite of what the company, in this case 3M, you know, wanted to accomplish, because they were in the business of making stronger residues, you know, basically adhesives. You know, they wanted to make things that are better. And here's a guy who spends years working on a weak adhesive. He was just basically, you know, doing exactly the opposite of what the company was all about. And so a lot of that, you know, that persistence, and then of course discovering also an application for that as well. And yeah, so the story of innovation is usually a story that's much more similar to these kinds of things, you know, persistence, lots of failure along the way, than the other kind of stories where someone, you know, in the morning under the shower had suddenly an idea, lightning bolt, or an apple, you know, fell on their head and or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's usually not sort of how innovation works.
Yeah. So you also, this is interesting too, because it's how leadership can come in and screw up everything. Because you talk about the CEO of 3M, W. James McNerney Jr. And he became the head in the early 2000s, and he implemented Six Sigma, fired thousands of workers, tightened budgets. So how did that go?
Well, it's one of the things, you know, so when he came in to 3M at the time, you know, 3M was a legendary company,
yeah.
And they were really good at what we call exploration, you know, the ability to discover basically sort of new innovations, new technologies, and so forth. They were not very good at execution, or what we call often exploitation. And we had 55 divisions of 3M that didn't really communicate that well. You know, people had kind of a get out of the way attitude. You know, they were working on their own things without management permission. So McNerney kind of comes in here, and he was trained in Six Sigma, which is all about standardizing, getting rid of waste, making things predictable, and so forth. You know, and they did a lot of that, you know, under Jack Welch at GE. And so he comes in, he does all this, and he starts to put sort of Six Sigma sort of in this place. And what's interesting, what happens, you know, right away, actually, the financial results improve. You know, the market loved it. You know, Wall Street loved it. And but what he did is he took it too far. You know, Six Sigma is a methodology that comes from production. And I know that because I was actually living in Arizona at the time, you know, when it was some sort of invented. It was really using statistics to improve productivity and quality of manufacturing processes at Motorola. But it's not so suitable for upstream innovation. And so what he did is he ended up pushing this really hard. And suddenly, you know, you had scientists, you know, who were much further upstream in the organization, had to become Six Sigma black belts, and they had to make things more predictable and so forth. So what ended up happening is you took an organization that was really good at exploration and tried to kind of turn them into an organization that was really good at exploitation, operational execution, and they started to lose some of that innovativeness as a result of that. And what we find is great companies tend to be good at both. They're good at both exploration and exploitation. And it's the senior sort of executive's role to find a balance between the two. And so I think for 3M at the time, the pendulum had swung too far. It was too far maybe on the exploration side, and then it swung too far to the exploitation side. And so when the next CEO came in, George Bugley, he had to correct that. He had to find sort of a healthy middle ground.
That's interesting. The thing I picked up on when you talked about this was the importance of variability, which I guess when I was first, you know, and I'm not experienced in your world and these ideas, but the correlation I see in ours is that we are in an innovation space, and the variables and the edges, the, you know, the sort of outliers are usually where all the real sweet stuff is, the really good stuff. And I guess I didn't expect that in you know, talking about experimentation.
Absolutely. You know, variability in an operation setting, you know, variability can be a bad thing. And in fact, if you go into a factory, the best way to improve a factory is to eliminate variability. You can do that right away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I always tell people in a factory environment, variability is the enemy. But in innovation, variability can be your friend because variability creates opportunity. So trying to find outliers, trying to leverage variability sort of in a good way creates tremendous opportunity, and someone will move in there. And in fact, right now, I mean, again, bringing it to the context, you know, right now is probably the most uncertain time or the most variable time that we've seen in decades. And you can see what's happening around us. You know, people are trying all sorts of different things right now. I mean, there's lots of experimentation going on, and a lot of it will not work, but some of it will work. And I think we will look back to this period and we'll say, wow, you know, and here's a number of things that we actually discovered throughout sort of in this time that we would have probably not discovered if it just had been sort of normal times.
Yeah. All right. We're coming close to the end. There's two more stories I want to pluck out from you before before we ask you for a yes and story, and I'll explain that later. Talk to us about, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis, because this seems like a figure of interest for what's going on now.
Yes, I mean, there's a well-known effect called the Semmelweis reflex. Now, Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis was a pioneer in combating childbed fever in the 19th century. Now, Semmelweis, he was a Hungarian physician at the hospital in Vienna, and he found that childbed fever, which was, by the way, back then a fatal disease, it killed millions sort of women during childbirth, and he sort of felt that it was caused by doctors and students who had not probably washed their hands after performing, you know, postmortems on cadavers. So what he did is to counteract that, he instituted a policy requiring physicians and students to wash their hands thoroughly with a chlorinated lime solutions before they were examining patients. And what he found when they did that, the death rate fell by a factor of nearly 10. Now, at this point, we would say, wow, what an amazing discovery, right? Everybody should probably go ahead and do this. The problem was that Semmelweis couldn't explain why this happened because we didn't really have a good sort of theory of germs back then. You know, in fact, Louis Pasteur didn't prove, you know, the presence of these kinds of bacteria in women until 1879. So what ended up happening is the medical establishment actually ignored, they even ridiculed sort of his findings because it was completely sort of almost kind of counterintuitive for them that one condition would sort of cause all this, because at the time, they believed that every sort of disease had sort of a unique kind of cause. And so it was kind of an extreme conclusion for the medical establishment. So the poor guy at the time, Semmelweis, you know, he was just ridiculed. He ended up actually leaving, and he went back to Hungary, by the way, where he replicated the findings. But even then, they ridiculed him again, and he finally actually died in a mental hospital. And it was only after we had a theory, that is when Louis Pasteur came in, when we finally had a theory where he could explain why that was so, the treatment was finally accepted. And I think it's a big lesson for us. That's what's called the Semmelweis reflex, is that's our knee-jerk reaction of these kinds of findings when they go against sort of our conventional assumptions.
I can't believe the hand-washing guy went mad. I mean, this is so...
Yeah, it's crazy at the time, but, you know, people could, because he couldn't explain it. You know, he couldn't sort of tell them why it was so. It was just an empirical observation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
You talk about a presentation you gave a few years ago on business experimentation, and the CEO of a national restaurant chain energetically disagreed with you.
Yeah, so I have, you know, Kelly, I have this one chapter on myths.
Yeah.
And it was the last chapter because I thought it was important to write this. You know, people would say, okay, if experimentation is so great, why don't more companies do this at much larger scale? So I listed seven myths that I typically run into, you know, when I'm talking about this. And one of these myths is called experimentation-driven innovation will kill intuition and judgment. And the way I discovered this is through this talk that you referenced. I was giving this talk, and you know how important experimentation is and testing and all this. And he was really upset. He got up and said, "Listen, what you're trying to tell me here is not going to work. I've been telling my people that intuition and judgment is really important. You know what you're prescribing will kill creativity and so on and so on." And I tried to explain to him that it's not one or the other. It's basically putting them together is what makes them so powerful. You know, it's not, you know, even when you're running experiments or when you're running tests, the hypotheses or the ideas have to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so the companies who do this, they use intuition and they use judgment and they use lots of qualitative techniques. They use focus groups, by the way. They do all the kinds of things that everybody else does. But what they do is they insert an additional step, and that is they insert a test or an experiment rather than just taking these things and running directly to market with them. And so I think that's really important. So what I'm sort of telling people is you don't have to dismiss all the things that you're doing. I'm just telling you, put sort of that additional step in there, because at some point, everybody will run a test. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you're going to have to go reality. Even if you're in a theater, at some point, you have to lift the curtain and you have an audience.
Right.
And if something doesn't work, you may want to know before you actually lift the before you lift the curtain, before the audience sits there, because then it gets really expensive if you find out that something doesn't work. And so that's what these companies are doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way we create our content at Second City is we have two acts of scripted content. We have the third act, which is where we improvise, and that is where we test out material. And it's not until a scene is sort of being well received that we start to put it in the regular show, and we do that over like a 10 or 12 week period. So we literally like crowdsource our comedy in front of an audience, making sure it all works before we set an opening night. So it's like testing every single, you know, performance. The whole idea around yes and it's funny because I go and talk at conferences as well, and invariably I'll talk about this idea of yes and, about creating from abundance, as the front end of a creative process. And there's always a guy who's like, if I yes anded every idea, I would never get any work done. And like instantly I know two things: that's a terrible person to work with, and missing the point, because this is about the beginning. This is about like testing out all the stuff before you go to market. I actually hadn't made the connection until just then, and thinking about how that whole yes and concept actually is experimentation.
I tell people test early and often.
Yeah. Right.
All
right. Yeah, so at the end of the podcast, we always ask our guests if they themselves have a yes and story. So the idea here in improvisation is when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they can't do that alone, and they get nowhere by saying no. And just saying yes actually isn't enough. You have to say yes and. You have to explore and heighten in order to build a scene together. So I'm wondering, from your work or life, was there a moment when you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and?
I have many moments, Kelly. I'll give you one example that actually goes very well with the story that you just told the audience about theater. And so, you know, I of course, since I'm a professor, so I do a lot of teaching, and sometimes some of the most interesting teaching innovations that I found came from something going wrong. And so here's the story. So I'm in class and I'm teaching this case study on Apple, which I wrote. Mm-hmm. And there's an audience, you know, it's about 70 people sitting there. They're very, very senior executives, the CEO of a very, very large company sitting there. And I had a teaching plan for 75 minutes. A couple days before the course started, they had changed the teaching times to 90 minutes. And for some reason, I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, no.
So I have sort of, everything in front of me, and I'm going through the teaching plan. I'm getting near the end of the class, you know, hitting 75 minutes, and I suddenly realize that I've got another 15 minutes to go. So here I am. And so then what do you do? You know, now I had some choices. One choice would be just to fess up. And saying, listen, guys, you know, we had this great class together, you know, and it's near the end, and I'll give you a longer break. And I'm sure they wouldn't mind, you know, right. They have a longer break and where they could network and chat and do their phone calls and all that. Or I could say, yes, and mm-hmm. Why not use that as an opportunity to innovate, you know, on the fly? Yeah. Why not improvise and come up with something that's very different? And that's what I did. And so what I did is I just, on the fly, just inserted sort of another segment that wasn't in the plan. And the segment was basically sort of a fascinating question. That is, put them into small groups to brainstorm and ask themselves, what would happen if Apple ran your company? What would you change? Mm-hmm. And it turned out that single question just made all the difference in the class. Before that, I had always taught it without that question at the end.
Yeah.
And people then came up to me after the class and told me, I said, you know, this was a great class, but that last question that you asked, that really made all the difference. And from then on, you know, I basically, every single time I taught this class, I taught it with sort of with this question at the end. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I discovered the question, because I said yes, and I used sort of that almost screw up that I was responsible for, I used that as an opportunity to try something new.
I love it. That is a great story. You were improvising.
Absolutely. I'll tell you a quick story, Kelly, a quick theater story, which I got from my friend. You know, so one of my hobbies is magic. And so I worked for the last 10 years with one of the world's leading close-up magicians, Jason Randall. And he's been performing, you know, his whole life. You know, he's probably has about now, I would say about 40, 45 years of performance experience. Mm-hmm. But he told me this amazing story. His father used to be a theater professor.
Okay.
And at UCLA. And amazing story. So this was about performance on the stage. Mm-hmm. And so he told me sort of the story about actually a theater director once, you know, sort of told the story. I think it was told him to his father or told him directly. I don't remember sort of how the story came about. But that theater director, the way he had this technique for actually sort of elevating the performance of sort of actors. And one of the problems of actors is, of course, is after a while they get really comfortable with their performance and they hit a plateau. Mm-hmm. You know, we call it in academia a local optimum. Okay. They don't try anything anymore.
Right.
So what this guy did is, so when these actors were on stage, he would take a feather and he would go and tickle their feet. and it would kind of really get them, you know, off balance. Mm-hmm. And it was intentional because he learned by actually, if you want to get someone's performance up, you have to kind of get them off balance. And by tickling their feet, you know, they would kind of get so messed up that either they would completely crash or they would immediately improvise and then kind of find a new plateau, a new level of performance. And so I thought I use that sometimes, that metaphor sometimes with people, you know, tickle their feet. Yeah. I always tell people, what do you do to tickle your own feet, you know, to make sure that you in life don't get sort of stuck at some plateau because you get so damn comfortable with it.
Well, this is a thing, right? You when you become very good at something and you keep doing it, there's not a lot of incentive to stop doing it, except you do stop.
Absolutely.
In it, you know, I mean,
we face this in the classroom too,
sure,
because we get really good teachers, really good case teachers, and it works so well. And so I had to always remind myself to try out new things, you know, maybe put, you know, introducing magic into that classroom, or I started using Legos and things like that, kind of doing things that are completely different than what we normally use just to get me off balance.
Yeah.
And get me sort of wonderful to try different things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm glad you shared that with me. Thank you. The book is called Experimentation Works, The Surprising Power of Business Experiments. Stefan Tomke, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for hiring me, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumblebear, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young, but my body won't play along. I'm thinking this must not be where we belong. And the world split in two from the throng of every living soul.
survive.